panel moderator and chair, sort of a Jane of all trades. The title of this panel discussion is Not Just Lip Service, How We Can Help Gays and Lesbians Feel Welcome in Our Religious Community. What I'll do to start off with is thank you all for coming. Thank all the panelists for willing to participate, some on shorter notice than others, and I'm appreciative of their being here to help with the discussion. We will be hearing from panelists John Blood, Ben Jarvis at the end, Bob Rees, and Anna Rolapp in whatever order they decide to rush to the microphone in. I will have them introduce themselves and tell a little bit more about what they bring to this discussion from their particular points of view. I'll tell you a little bit about how this panel came about. During the recent political activity in California, and I think you all know what that euphemism refers to, I became concerned that the sentiments that I was hearing voiced in church didn't seem to align with the gospel of love that I understand and believe in and cherish. It was a little disconcerting to be Mormon lately at some points in time. I was concerned with some of the sentiments that were voiced at church that from some people could only be described as anti-gay. I know that that wasn't the sentiments of everyone involved with the Prop 22 things going on at church, but there were some instances, you know, in my ward, ones that I heard about, that really, you know, couldn't be called anything else. And I was aware that the church's official position didn't really condone those types of sentiments, and that perhaps some folks, for the sake of being on the right side of the political fence, were perhaps not entirely reflecting what the church has said about how we treat gay and lesbian Mormons. I knew of people in my ward and within the larger Mormon community who were also distressed by the events that took place in California. And what I wanted to do, partly with this panel and partly, you know, on a personal level and on a larger level here today, was talk about what the official position of the church is with regard to gay and lesbian Mormons and explore ways that we as members, varying degrees of the LDS religious community, can help close the divide between words and behavior as far as how we treat gay and lesbian Mormons. I wanted to explore with you today some of the ways that we can go beyond lip service of saying we're loving and tolerant and act in ways that tangibly reflect our love and acceptance and support of gay and lesbian Mormons. How we'll go ahead and proceed with this session is we'll begin with a brief overview of the official position of the church. Then each of the panelists will have about 10 minutes or so to introduce themselves, discuss whether the official position of the church reflects their experience at church or with LDS church members. And after each of the panelists has had a say, we will then field suggestions, constructive criticisms, and brilliant ideas from the audience at large on how we can improve and what we can do better to reach out and fellowship and genuinely love and welcome gay and lesbian Mormons in our religious community. So that said, I'm going to voice a few disclaimers. I acknowledge that the LDS Church's active role in supporting Proposition 22 was a catalyst for me to put this panel together. However, I would prefer that the afternoon sessions take care of most of the specifically Prop 22 directed conversation. I would rather have us here focused today on the healing process rather than the wound itself and discuss what we can learn from what has been, to a lot of people, a painful chapter of modern Mormon history. Again, I'd like to see what we can do better, how we can improve. and encourage panelists and audience members to share their experiences. I'm hoping that we'll have time for a robust question and answer session and be able to come to some real ways that we can demonstrate our love and tolerance, and what we can do to create a loving environment in the LDS community for all Mormons. I'm sure some of the things that we arrive at today will have broader application within the LDS community than to just gay and lesbian Mormons. I know that there are a lot of people who don't necessarily fit into the nuclear family, husband, wife, children, dog, picket fence picture of Mormonism. And so I think there are a lot of areas where we can improve. But this was the one that I felt most strongly about, simply because recently we have perhaps not been as warm and loving toward our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. So, I'll go ahead and talk a little bit about the official position of the church. This is by no means exhaustive. I'm sure that there's a lot more information out there about this topic, but I'm looking basically at a couple of conference talks given by Gordon B. Hinckley over the last couple of years. And there are a couple of Ensign articles published recently also that discuss the position of the LDS Church with regard to gay and lesbian Mormons. The first one was a 1998 conference address in which Gordon B. Hinckley addressed the specific question, what is your church's attitude toward homosexuality? And he said, people inquire about our position on those who consider themselves so-called gays and lesbians. My response is that we love them as sons and daughters of God. They may have certain inclinations which are powerful and which may be difficult to control. Most people have inclinations of one kind or another at various times. If they do not act upon these inclinations, then they can go forward as do all other members of the church. If they violate the laws of chastity and the moral standards of the church, then they are subject to the discipline of the church just as others are. He goes on to say, we want to help these people, to strengthen them, to assist them with their problems, and to help them with their difficulties. But we cannot stand idle if they indulge in immoral activity, if they try to uphold and defend and live in a so-called same-sex marriage situation. To permit such would be to make light of the very serious and sacred foundation of God-sanctioned marriage and its very purpose, the rearing of families. And what I drew out of these statements was, I have a problem with the so-called being thrown in front of anything, because I think it belittles whatever comes afterwards. I don't think that really connotes a whole lot of respect for people who label themselves such or not. I feel like the sentiments expressing love and a desire to help and strengthen are genuine. However, these are also greatly outweighed by the consequences if people do not follow the rules. It seems to me that the message is, we love you, but as long as you control yourself. And while that can be helpful in some ways, I feel that perhaps the greater emphasis should be on the sentiments that we want to love and help those and strengthen those who have difficulties. Another conference talk that discusses this was given in October of 99, again by President Hinckley. He was speaking specifically about the LDS activity in California as far as the church's support of Proposition 22. He says in these remarks, nevertheless, and I emphasize this, I wish to say that our opposition to attempts to legalize same-sex marriage should never be interpreted as justification for hatred, intolerance, or abuse of those who profess homosexual tendencies, either individually or as a group. As I said from this pulpit 1 year ago, our hearts reach out to those who refer to themselves as gays and lesbians. We love and honor them as sons and daughters of God. They are welcome in church. It is expected, however, that they follow the same God-given rules of conduct that apply to everyone else, whether married or single. And this statement struck me as a little bit more moderate, a little bit more balanced in what it was saying. Thankfully, he lost the so-called as part of his remarks. But again, my concern is that the professions of love and welcome are closely followed by admonitions to follow the rules. And some people may interpret this as the welcome being contingent on gay and lesbians following the rules as laid out in Mormon doctrine and practice. So while I think, again, the sentiments are genuine about reaching out to these members of the LDS population, I still think more perhaps could be said about how we do that. How do we reach out? How do we express ourselves in ways that show love and honor to gay and lesbian Mormons? There was an article published in the Ensign by, I think his name is Dean Bird, and his article specifically addressed when a loved one struggles with same-sex attraction, and he lists some helpful hints on how to navigate this particular situation. Didn't particularly care for the article myself, because again, I think it focuses on it. Well, it names the central conflict. It says family members and friends often experience shock and confusion when they learn that a loved one struggles with homosexual attraction. And the question he asks is this: how do they manage their conflicting feelings and balance love and compassion with the Lord's declaration that homosexual relations are sinful? And at least in the brief overview of the literature that I've looked at, the latter tends to be more emphasized than the former. We hear a lot about God's position on the issue. We don't hear quite as much helpful information about how to balance love and compassion, or how to better display those tendencies rather than calling gay and lesbian Mormons to repent or insisting that that their behavior is not what God wants to have happen. So I think that there's certainly a lot more we can do as far as, you know, I think a lot of ways the church's position talks a lot more about the justice end of things and not quite as much about the mercy end of things. You know, a lot about the fact that God considers fornication, adultery, and homosexual relations as grievous sins. Well, that's true, but at the same time, that's not the only thing that God says about dealing with difficult situations, and in this one in particular. The Bird article, the one that I just mentioned, it reminds me a lot of a play that I've seen advertised for around Los Angeles called I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change. So that's kind of the sentiment that I get from that particular article, because it does seem to be very focused on the fact that, you know, if everyone would just change, everything would be all right. And I don't think that's really the answer here. There's also an Ensign article published by Dallin Oaks on same-gender attraction, and he makes a few distinctions that the other folks I've looked at have not. He distinguishes between homosexual orientation and homosexual behavior, condemning the latter as being contrary to the Lord's plan, but at the same time not issuing a blanket condemnation on all homosexuals for simply existing, which I think is a difference that hasn't been as obvious in the literature before. He quotes a letter from the First Presidency saying that there is a distinction between immoral thoughts and feelings and participating in either immoral heterosexual or any homosexual behavior. So there does seem to be a small faint line drawn in the sand, which I think is somewhat of a step. And he also goes on to say that our doctrines obviously condemn those who engage in, unfortunately, another so-called gay bashing, either physical or verbal attacks on persons thought to be involved in homosexual or lesbian behavior. So he does condemn gay bashing, but at the same time, what frustrates me about the literature is there's not enough really for me to sink my teeth into as far as, okay, what can we do differently? What can we do to show the love and compassion that we profess to have? So at this point, I will ask the panelists to come forward and introduce themselves, again, explain their position with relationship to this discussion, to discuss whether their experience reflects this official position regarding gay and lesbian Mormons, and then at the end we'll open the floor for discussion and suggestions for ways that we can improve. Also, I want to remind everyone that this session is being taped, so if we have questions at the end, we'll ask you to come up to the microphone so we make sure to capture the flavor of what you're asking or saying, and we'll ask the panelists also to come up to the microphone, and we'll go from there. Who's first?
I'll do it.
Okay, you're closest.
And I'll be the briefest.
Thank you, Mary Ellen, for your comments. I think you kind of set the groundwork quite nicely. I was asked to be on this panel because I have a gay son. I'm assuming that's why I was asked. Our 18-year-old son came out when he was 14 years old, much to horror and dismay, I'm embarrassed to say, of his parents. But it's been a wonderful road that we have gone down the past 4 years, and I'm to almost to the point that my dear friend Betty Ann is at, where she can say, I am so happy to have a gay son. Well, I'm very proud to have a gay son. He's an amazing young man, and I'm very happy for the insight that I've gained in recent years. Our experience, we are in the Los Angeles stake in Westwood Second Ward, and for the most part, our experiences with the patriarchal leadership have been extremely positive. And I know that it's unusual. My son thanks me often that I'm raising him in Southern California as opposed to raising him in a state so much to the Northeast. And I think that's been an important an important aspect of his life. I'll try to stay focused more on the topic than on what has transpired with Terry over the years. But the two bishops that we have had in the last 4 years have been tremendously supportive. The first bishop, when Terry first came out, had a constant open door for Terry, and there was never any judgment passed down upon him. There was only love and what can I do to help you, what would you like to talk about. The bishop often said things like, I really don't understand homosexuality, what can you teach me about it, how can I be your friend, is basically what he was telling him, and I've always been appreciative of that. Our current bishop is much younger and tends to be a lot more conservative than the previous bishop, but he has kept an open door policy with our son and has given him callings that have been very appropriate and very helpful for Terry and his development. I recognize a lot of the faces in the audience that are familiar with the Third Friday group that took place in the Los Angeles stake for some time and unfortunately has been discontinued. A former stake president of the Los Angeles stake organized some years ago a group once a month for gay and lesbians in the Los Angeles area to get together and meet under priesthood leadership at our building. It was a very, very successful group that went on for some years, two or for 4 years, Unfortunately, it was shut down by Salt Lake City about 3 years ago. And if there are any other such groups that have started since then, I would love to know about them, because it was such a valuable time for my son to come together with other men that were striving to stay active in the church. And these men, I was only able to attend the meeting 3 or 4 times, and I've never felt the Spirit quite so strongly as I did in these meetings. The music, as you can imagine, was incredible. The bearing of testimonies was really a wonderful experience. A year and a half ago, I decided to ride my bicycle in the AIDS ride to raise money for AIDS causes and AIDS awareness and AIDS health-related services. And I rode with a girlfriend of mine. Between the two of us, we had absolutely no problem raising about $10,000, and most of that money did come from the LDS community. And that was a rather surprise to me at the amount of support that we did get for that. There have been several people in our ward, including my dear friend Betty Ann, that have paved the way and made it much easier for me and for my son by speaking out in the past on gay issues in our congregation. And it has kind of set the groundwork for a really, really loving and open reception for my son and many other gay men in our congregation. As recently as a couple months ago, the fast and testimony meeting that took place in our ward the Sunday before the big vote on Tuesday was a fast and testimony meeting that I will never remember. The gays of all our congregation all bore their testimonies. Excuse me? Thank you. Always remember. Thank you. I appreciate that. An event I will always remember. Never forget. But several gay members of our congregation bore their testimony, and the bishop had asked the congregation at the beginning of the fast and testimony meeting to try to not let it become a political meeting, which was a little upsetting to me when he first made that announcement, because for many weeks previous to that sacrament meeting, I felt like it had become a political forum. We were being told how to vote. And on this particular Sunday, he asked us to avoid letting the meeting, the fast and testimony meeting, become a political forum. But as these men all bore their, it was all men, but as these men all bore their testimonies, they bore testimonies of love of the Savior, and it truly was a wonderful experience. They all expressed angst and how painful the campaigning on behalf of Prop 22 had been for them, but they all bore strong testimonies of the Savior and their desire to stay close to Him. And I thought that was a really wonderful culmination for some months that had been very painful for a lot of other people. Our son at this point is not particularly active in the church, though he does hold a calling. He has explored many, many religions over the last couple of years. He's a deeply spiritual young man, and we've pretty much at age 18, he is a man. He's his own self, and we're very excited to see how his life will turn out, and we give him our full love and support. Thank you.
Oh, this works. What a difference a day can make. Yesterday, I had no idea that I would be here in Los Angeles presenting on this panel, and 24 hours later, here I am. And I also had an occasion to talk to my mother yesterday. I was interviewed for an article in the Arizona Republic in Mesa, Arizona. And I called Mom to say, hey, you might be getting some phone calls because we have family members in Mesa. Of course, Mom graduated from Mesa High School, and her reunion is this coming weekend, so she's going to be famous. And as I had her on the phone, she said, well, Ben, what are you doing tomorrow? Your brother and I are going to be at this symposium at the Hilton at LAX. And I said, well, what a coincidence. I'm speaking at the same symposium. So, yeah, let's definitely get together for lunch. So, indeed, what a difference 24 hours can make in a person's life. Again, my name is Ben Jarvis. I'm born and raised in the church. I come from a long and very proud line of Mormons. On both sides of my family, my heritage extends all the way back to the founding of the religion in upstate New York. I have no regrets for being born into the church. The church has given me so many positive things throughout my life, and it's been a very interesting experience for me coming out as a gay man and actually completing my role as a Latter-day Saint. Last year, I canceled my membership in the church due to the Proposition 22 involvement here in the state of California. And that was not something that came easy for me. That was a very long and drawn-out process. And in my resignation letter that I wrote, it actually probably took 4 months for me to get the letter down to a single page, well thought out, at least I hope well thought out, document. At times it had swelled up to like 10 or 12 pages with profanity and everything else in there. But when I finally sent to the local bishop, it was well thought out and pretty much to the point. If you were to ask someone who knows me well, ask them what kind of music I like, I would answer definitely, or they would answer definitely, Ben is a child of the 80s, and that's very, very true. The 1980s, that was the decade where I formed a lot of my opinions politically, spiritually, and where I first really learned who I was as an individual. And there's a particular artist from the early 80s, a woman by the name of Kate Bush, and some of you may be familiar with her work. All of her songs are very emotional and intense, filled with just really great meaning. And she sings a song about wanting to make a deal with God and getting God to swap places with her. And when I first heard that song on the radio almost 20 years ago, you know, bingo, that just totally struck a chord in me because, you know what, I kind of wanted to make a deal with God too. And I'd like to get God to come down and, you know, swap places with me. Because as a freshman in high school in Escondido, California, very active in the church, I didn't know what to do with the feelings that I had inside of me. And this one song by Kate Bush just really seemed to frame in a very nice, neat way all of the emotions that I was feeling. Well, how ironic, later on in my life when I came out of the closet and started dealing with the LDS Church on a very personal level, that I could go back to the same song that struck me so many years ago and find meaning in another passage. In that song, there's a lyric that says, "You don't want to hurt me, but see how deep the bullet lies." And that essentially sums up the experience that I have had with the church, the church's policy and treatment by the majority of the members since I came out. Gordon B. Hinckley can say whatever he wants about homosexuals being welcome in the LDS Church. He can call us good people. He can say that he loves us and that he welcomes us. But when the rubber hits the road, I have my experience and the experience of many close friends and acquaintances that points to a very different realization. And the realization that I've come to is that gay and lesbians have absolutely no place in the LDS Church. You know, maybe we do in the greater community, and certainly I'm Mormon by birth, and that's just simply a fact of life. I'll be Mormon till the day that I die. But unfortunately, it's all too clear to me personally that the time and the effort that I invested in the LDS Church, you know, it's done. It's completed, and I've had to move on. That was not an easy thing for me to do. I wasn't naive when I started my process back. Actually, it dates way back into junior high school, but the moving and the shaking really happened when my mom confronted me in 1993 in our famous conversation, where she basically got tired of asking me if I was gay and essentially just came out and said, "Okay, I know you're gay, now what are we going to do about it?" I knew that there would be issues between me and the church. But one thing that I'm very proud of in my coming out process and my family's coming out process was that nothing that we did was rational or a knee-jerk reaction. Everything was very deliberate, articulate, planned. I was in no rush to come out of the closet. I was a very involved individual at that time in my life in 93. I was in my second year of graduate school at UC Irvine. I had an active social life, and this all in addition to the church activity, and God only knows how I pulled that off in grad school, to hold down two full-time jobs, to be active in the church, and to do everything else that I was doing. But as I started to take baby steps out of the closet, and as word started getting around the ward, this was in the Irvine 7th Ward in the Irvine stake in Orange County, my relationship with church began to change fundamentally. And with 18 months, my entire Mormon perspective had been turned upside down. Sparing you all the gory details, I'll just simply say that as long as I was willing to act, as long as I was willing to fill the expectations that the church leaders had and other board members had for me, everything was fine. I could continue to be a home teacher. I could continue to sing in the choir, to do temple work. They were very willing to take from me anything ever. But the moment that I started to assert myself and raise my hand in priest and say, well, you know, guys, I don't really agree with that, that's where the water started getting a little rough. And I was somewhat surprised to find that as the water started, you know, as the grain started to get rough, I actually found that I had a much firmer rudder in myself than I had, you know, in what was being told at church. My experience, probably the most notable experience that I had, was when I was called into the stake president's office and given an ultimatum to either pretend to be straight, even if I wasn't, or, you know, to expect the consequences from that. I mean, there was no specific threat of church discipline, but I mean, the implied threat was certainly there, and at that point that scared me, because the church even then was still the most important thing in my life. It was the center of who I was as a person, culturally, socially. Everything in my life was somehow tied and connected to the church. And I panicked. Now, at least I have, you know, the ability to say that I never lost my dignity in that interview. And in fact, you know, at some level it was certainly entertaining, because I could just sit there and, like Bart Simpson, just keep, you know, saying, well, why? And before you knew it, the stake president was like slamming his fist on the table and raising his voice. And, you know, so it wasn't without some value to me, you know, you know, as far as entertainment went. But nonetheless, you know, when I went home, I was stunned. And I didn't tell my parents for 3 days after this interview, because I just didn't know what they would think. And actually, my younger sister was the first person to really find out what had happened. And as I recounted all of this to Ellen, I just broke down, kind of like I'm doing now. And as I told her what the stake president had said to me, and what the implied threats were, and all of the information that was conveyed there in that meeting, Ellen's first reaction was like, well, you didn't believe any of it, did you? No, not really, but that didn't change the fact that I really felt that my church membership was in jeopardy if I remained under the jurisdiction of the Irvine stake. And this was a little bit more complicated, because the way that that stake worked, I was in a singles ward that covered two other stakes in the surrounding area. So essentially, all of South Orange County was off limits to me, and I had to escape, you know, which, again, looking back, I see that that really wasn't a bad thing. That had been all that I had had to go on with the church. I think my feelings would have been a lot more negative than they are today. But fortunately, we did have people in LA Affirmation who lived in the LA state. I was going to the third floor meeting in Los Angeles regularly. And we all kind of could see the handwriting on the wall. We knew that any of us that came out individually in our own stakes and wards, that we would not be able to have as meaningful a relationship with the church locally as we would have in the LA stake. So I was one of the people who actually transferred into the Westwood Second Ward. And I'm very, very happy that I did that, because coming from Orange County, where I just had this traumatic experience, I found the people of the Westwood Second Ward to be exemplary in their interpretation of the gospel, in really having a true feeling or a true understanding that, you know, love was the foundation of the LDS Church and the LDS faith. I think that if I had not had that intervention, if you will, I would probably have very different feelings today. My journey beyond the Westwood Ward, you know, things happened in my life. I took another job, and, you know, if you think about it, I guess I must be a glutton for punishment, because not only did I come out of the closet in Orange County, after that, I took a job in Santa Clarita, which, as some of you know, is home to Pete Knight. So, yes, that was my state senator that did the whole Prop 22 thing. And Santa Clarita is home to, like, the largest gay and lesbian dinner group organization in LA, so even try to figure that out. He's obviously not listening to his constituents, but it was in Santa Clarita that I finally settled down, found someone. My partner Pat and I have been together now for going on 3 years, and there just came a point when I realized that there was nothing left for me within the confines of the LDS Church. And I was profoundly sad, because it's not like having a project or writing a school paper, but the church was a very big part of my life. And to get to the point where you have to say, you know, it's taken me as far as I can go, but now I have to step off and, you know, find my own way. It was a very, very sad time in my life. However, I was not willing to be a part of an organization that systematically and deliberately worked against the civil rights of others. And in this case, it just happens I am a member of that group that the church was working against. But I would hope that this would be my reaction had I been old enough in the ERA thing back in the years, or even with people of African descent. I would hope that my reaction would be the same. So today I am LDS free, but still just as Mormon as I've ever been. And in fact, the irony through all of this, and any of you who know gay, lesbian Mormons, you'll know that irony and paradox just goes with the territory. No matter what I do, I will always be Mormon. And coming out of the closet and standing up and getting involved politically and in the community and all this, these are all very Mormon things. So the more, if you want to look at it this way, the more I try not to be LDS, the more and more Mormon I become. And I'm okay with that. So, anyways, it's been a real bumpy ride, but one that I'm so happy that I've been able to take. And I just am so full of gratitude for my parents, my family, and the church members that are there to stand up and to buck the popular trend and to actually make a difference in the lives of people, because they do make a difference. Thank you.
Can you hear me okay from this distance? Yeah? Okay. Hi. My name is John Blood. I've been a member of the church since 1977. This is one of the very few times I've done public speaking, and I've been inactive. I almost say really inactive since almost from the beginning of my membership at the church. I was introduced to the church through some of the concepts in the theology, like men and women becoming gods together, and the idea that all truth is one great eternal round. All of it fits together eventually. Whatever truth you have will eventually make sense if you learn enough and if you know enough. And my approach, approach to the church, or attitude about the church, was based on that. It was very idealistic. That I expected the behavior of the membership to follow that. I thought, well, here's the blueprint, let's go for it. And that people would stumble and fall and go off course and come back. But I thought, yes, this is something, this is freedom. There's no original sin in Mormon theology. There's no inequality in the structure of the conceptualizing. And on that level, it's still a part of my life. It's still very important to me. Prop 22 was the campaign of the church in support of Prop 22 was a real slap in the face. I'd become semi-active over the last year. A friend of mine, Jeff Parkin, called me up and said, "Hey, you know, you're on the membership roll. Can we come over?" And I went, okay. And I thought of putting everything I would have a problem with as I saw it on the table when they actually showed up. I mean, you know, a bowl of beer and a cup of coffee. And I thought, no. So I thought I would just see how it went. It went fine. And they asked me if I wanted home teachers. And I went, all right. Was that my attitude pretty much? Yeah, I was like, okay. And because I'd been, I guess I'll backtrack a moment, as my introduction was to the theology more or less. And I joined it was in a college branch, which is more informal. Most people were students. They were going to college. They were used to thinking and questioning. And that's what I was accustomed to. And I didn't really know what I was doing, in my opinion. My college branch president at the time, when I was thinking of becoming baptized, said, "Well, you got to work hard and believe it's true." Well, I'd had some experience with, it was probably Second Nephi reading, something was going on with that. I mean, I got a very clear impression of Nephi speaking when I was reading it that one time. And everybody I knew at the time was in the church. So that was where I was coming from. And it felt like a good thing to do. And that's about as deep as it went. I mean, I realized the attitude, at least at different times in the church, is that it doesn't really matter why you're baptized. You're baptized, you know, keep working on it. I think I was a fool. That's how I've looked at it most of the time. It took me until 1991 to realize that, as far as I could tell, at least the membership, at least in California, was pretty much like any other white middle class group. I could expect the same kinds of things out of the Mormon church that I could out of any other group of that day in California. It finally, I kept being, I don't know, uncomfortable or upset with the membership or with something I'd pick up at church. And my mode of behavior through most of my life is, if it's uncomfortable, I'll just drift away. I just won't show up anymore. I mean, I grew up with my dad telling me that I was worthless, specifically to my face, repeatedly. Part of me believed it. And that's something I carried with me my whole life, and I still work on it. And the Prop 22 campaign is sort of a reinforcement of that. That's the way it feels. I'm not saying that's what it is. I'm really not sure what it is. The campaign for Prop 22, not just with the church, to me seemed to be where people who took the term marriage as part of their identity, they took the term marriage, the concept, felt threatened. They felt their identities threatened, and they reacted from that. You know, they weren't thinking, and that's why I was puzzled by the behavior. There seemed to be something going on I wasn't understanding, and it appeared to be irrational. I think to some extent it was. I don't know if the church is wrong in its support of marriage. I can't say. I don't know. But it was the way the campaign was run that I'm not surprised it passed because of the climate in California. But when I came home from voting Tuesday I think it initially about 8 or 9 p.m. was Prop 22 was passing, I don't know, 3-1 or something like that. I felt like I got hit in the stomach, and I bent over and had trouble breathing for a minute. So what I thought was going on was not how it felt. I'm really not sure yet what's going on emotionally with me. I don't quite understand it. It didn't feel good. My membership in the church, or my connection to the church, is really tenuous. I was converted to the guy that introduced me to the church more than the church. It took me until 91 to figure that out. He had to point it out to me. And he was gay. And I've been semi-active for about a year, and I'm not willing to keep my mouth shut anymore. And most of my life I've tried to be invisible, because it was easier growing up that way. it was easier to try to hide from my dad in his anger than trying to confront it. It was useless to try to confront it. Or I'd try to escape. Now, this is a pretty specific context. This is not general. This is specific to me. I also have never had a testimony of Christ. I realize that's an unusual perspective. I feel sort of inside and outside at the same time. But someone pointed out to me yesterday that that perspective might be useful to the people here. I guess I wanted to ask also, how many are lifetime members of the church here in the audience? We've got about 30-40%. And so I thought that was important for me to know, to try to understand where church members are coming from. I don't really understand where they're coming from, where church members, you, are coming from. Full-time, active, believing church members. As far as I'm concerned, there are many times right now when I think that if I feel threatened with excommunication, I'm like ready to go for it. I'm just not interested in holding back anymore. But I realize that I also feel a connection to the church. I don't know what that is. I don't know if it's a connection through the man that introduced me to the church, who basically felt that the church was true and he was gay and he was waiting for more to be revealed. That was his position before he died. And so I feel a connection. I don't want to be negative. I want to be positive. I want to help. I either don't want to do anything, or I want to be positive and help make change. And I realize that using anger is a good motive force. Anger is very effective. Anger is very natural. And that, but letting it sit, it doesn't have to fester and doesn't have to bind us. I know there's anger on the side of the anti-Prop 22 people. I don't remember if I identified or not, but I am bisexual. I'm not homosexual specifically. From talking with gays and lesbians over the years and going to different meetings such as the Fireside and Third Fridays and affirmation meetings, that I realize I don't think I really understand what it is to be gay or gay. It seems to be a different perspective. It feels for me. And I understand that there's the anger on that side. I suspect there's some anger or something emotional on the side of the pro 20 people as well. And I was reading an article by an interview with Mel White, who was a ghostwriter for Jerry Falwell and a lot of the other people on the far right, and he came out as gay in 95, I believe, or mid-90s, and he's a reverend now, and he has a partner they've been together for a few years now. But at the end of the article, I'm sorry I didn't write it down and excerpt it, but he said that, you know, they've been the victims of misinformation just as much as we have. And I think, in other words, people who would support 22 or people who don't understand what's going on with anything other than straight, or as someone would say it, unstraight, the unstraight group. I think that's Mary Ellen's term. That the I'm not sure I understand what it is with me. I mean, gay, lesbian, straight seems pretty well-defined categories. Bisexual means something else. It's a different, I'm not sure I can describe it, but it is a different way of looking at things. It's a different way of, I'm not sure it's a different way of being, but it does feel different. It doesn't feel the same. But regardless of that, anger, I think, can be used as an excellent motive force. It doesn't have to sit and have to fester. My usual analogy for myself is it's like a radio transmitter. The power of the transmitter can be tuned to any frequency you want to carry out the radio signal so the information can be carried out. I think anger can be changed, any emotion probably, but anger can be modulated or tuned up to a different frequency to become a motive force, to be used in a positive fashion. At least with me, I have to remember to tell myself to use it and don't let it kill me, because it will. It really does eat me up when I think about this stuff. I wanted to identify and then offer something for strategy. That's part of it. I've also been reading Jerry Spence's book, How to Argue and Win Every Time. And the title is what attracted me at first. And I recommend the book highly to anybody who's interested in this kind of a subject of making positive change, because what Spence seems to have gotten and put into the book is, I'm not sure how long he's been a lawyer, but it's been a while, and he's been very successful for a while too. that it's like he's reached the wisdom stage of his career and his understanding. He puts more of a plan of life and an attitude about life than just beating other people up. His attitudes, in my opinion, or what he presents in the book, are really, in my opinion, very effective. Things like successful argument, this quote from him, successful argument is a communication between the acknowledged authority of both parties to the argument. Now, if I take that to heart, I can't simply, and I'm going to stay in church, or I'm not in a relationship, and I am semi-active right now, but if I'm going to maintain any kind of relationship church and not keep a mouth shut, I do need to be open and vulnerable to some extent and not just mouth off and not just be angry, because it will not work. I'm just another angry person at the church, and it's easier to dismiss me or easier just to see the anger. I think that's what most of it happens. If someone tries to teach anger, what people learn is the anger, not necessarily the content. That seems to be my experience with it. There's also another quote that I found useful. To affirm myself is to experience the courage to make the argument, for all argument begins with me. If I am valuable as an individual, if I have worth as an individual, which I feel in a connection with deity, in a connection with the universe, but not in a connection with God the Father. If I have worth and value, I need to affirm that. And sometimes that means seeking out, doing right, at least saying something is going on if there's something wrong. But I also, again, need to put it in a positive fashion. I'm not sure I'll read another quote from Spence. Without loving argument, this applies specifically to me and to growing up as well. Without loving argument, children can never experience the crucial gift of parenting or bring to fruition the parent-child relationship that produces the mature and functional adult. And I never got it. I was hiding most of the time when I was growing up. And most religious organizations, no, I'm sorry, not most, but many, have a view that fits right into that behavior. And I guess the only other thing I would say in closing at the moment is that, in terms of strategy, is that if I were to suggest to the church what to do, differently, bring back the fireside whatever time of the month they have it. Because when I went to the fireside, the gay and lesbian Mormon fireside that took place near the temple, I didn't attend many of them, or very consistently. And I didn't attend affirmation meetings very consistently at that time either. But it helped me to keep going. Because it was okay just to be. It was okay to be Mormon, to be gay or lesbian or bisexual or anything else, actually. It was just okay. And that's something that seems to be missing, in my experience, in the church, in the Mormon church. I don't feel okay being there. It feels sort of like enemy territory. Although the professions of are there, the actions are not following at this time. There is a, we support marriage, we support the family, this is not anti-gay, this is pro-family, and then the voting for Prop 22 occurs. Okay? We love our gay and lesbian children. Yes. I need the action, for me personally, to feel comfortable there. I don't feel welcome there. I do not feel okay as an individual there, because I don't think it supports me. I tried going to church recently just to show up, you know, to try to make it more consistent and have people get to know me without any labels. And I felt myself slipping into wanting to be part of the community, but because of my interpretation of the community, Mormon community where I go to church in Pasadena, that I began to feel kind of dead after that. I'm not sure it hit me that day, but it hit me in the week, because what I was doing, again, was closing off parts of myself that I felt did not fit into the group. That is the problem. I'm not saying it's necessarily a problem with the church, that specifically. That's how I react to it. I tend to shut down if I'm trying to be part of a group that appears not to accept me. So overall, strategy beyond that, I'm not really sure. My perspective is different than most. I still feel the connection to the church, at least to the theology, at least to the guy that introduced me to the church, who seemed to think it was true, even though he was gay. And I'm going to try to take it a day or a week at a time, but it seems it's not very hopeful at this time. It really doesn't. And that's pretty much it for now. Thanks. Thank you.
I think this is one of the more difficult problems that the contemporary church wrestles with. Some of the perhaps is seen even in the title of our discussion. I remember a friend of mine telling about being in a church meeting many years ago, someplace in the South Pacific, in which the visiting took place, let's say in Taiwan. And the visiting general authority said, we're very happy to have our Taiwanese brothers and sisters with us today. And he said, what I realized in that remark was that there seemed to be a difference between them and us, that in the very way we stated, if we talk about our community and making them a part of our community, they are our community. They are part, as much a part of our community, and I'm sure there was no intention, Mary Ellen, to have that meaning excluded from this title. But I think that nonetheless it often is a felt exclusion, that we're talking about them and us rather than all of us somehow together. It's to me an intriguing question. I wrestled with it weekly for the 5.5 years I was bishop of the Los Angeles Singles Ward, in which I went through a tremendous arc of understanding. And I owe a great deal to the gay and lesbian members of my ward who were courageous enough to be open with me and to teach me something about their experience. I am embarrassed at the lack of understanding I have had at some points in my life, and ashamed of some of my behavior in the past toward gays and lesbians. I continue to deal with this issue in the church because I think it is one that causes a lot of pain to individuals and to families. And as I think about what kinds of things we can do practically to make our services and our communities more hospitable for those who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, whatever their sexual orientation or feelings might be, I think that it is enormously difficult because of the fact that we seem to have an unbridgeable gap. And some of that has been addressed here today. The unbridgeable gap seems to be that people can be accepted in the church up to a certain point if they are gay or lesbian or otherwise gendered. Beyond that point, there seems to be no place for them, and this is why I think there are very few active gay and lesbian Latter-day Saints. Most people simply will not stay in the cauldron of pain and rejection for that long. They seek some other way to find happiness or peace, and many of them, most of them, I think, do not find it within our communities. And I think that's a condemnation both of us as individuals, Latter-day Saints, and I think it is also a condemnation of the church, that there is no room in the inn for many of these people, or the room in the inn is not the same room that the rest of us are privileged to occupy. So what are some of the things that can help us to deal with this very real problem? I think one way is to consider gays and lesbians as fully human as anyone else. And I think it takes some work to do that. It takes some work not to see them as somehow even special. I think that some of them object to being seen as special. They simply want to be seen and accepted as being fully human beings, not marred, not strange, but simply fully human. I think one of the things that we can do to, just in terms of practical things, is not to tell them that their situation is no different than single heterosexuals. I think that is a violation of their integrity to suggest this. As one thought wrote to a general authority, this simply isn't true. As a former bishop, I have firsthand experience. We openly love, support our single brothers and sisters. We give them important callings, especially with our youth and children. We urge them to date, to flirt, to get crushes, to fall in love, to marry. We sponsor warden stake activities and dances to get them together to accomplish this. We ask them to be chaste until they find someone to share their life and intimacy with. We go out of our way to give them something of immeasurable value in the struggle to keep the law of chastity, and that is hope. Hope that no matter how difficult this emotional and physical loneliness is, it is temporary. For those with least control over their situation, our single sisters, we give special encouragement and hope that they will find love, emotional intimacy, and fulfillment in this life, and if not, certainly in the next. We do not knowingly give homosexuals important callings, especially not with the youth or children who we think would be at risk from being infected or recruited. We forbid them ever to flirt, to date, to get crushes, to fall in love, to a legally recognized monogamous relationship. The image of a tri-state gay and lesbian golden green ball is amusing. We ask them to taste forever. No hope at all. The question of sexual intimacy aside, can you imagine having been denied the ability to become attracted to, flirt with, get a crush on, hold hands with, steal a kiss from, or fall in love with your wife? With all trace of romantic love and emotional intimacy denied you, with what would you fill the void, hold at bay a life of loneliness, emptiness, and despair? A father writing about his gay son and his primary experience with him. So I think one of the things that would be helpful is not to say that's just the same, because it clearly is not. It's dramatically different. I gave a talk to Family Fellowship in Salt Lake City in February, and in that I suggested some things that might be helpful, and let me just briefly run through those. First, I think we need to gather as much information as possible about homosexuality among the Mormons. There's a lot of ignorance about this. How many are there? What percentage? Et cetera, et cetera. How many have died of AIDS or committed suicide? Far too many. I've been told by someone who has an enormous archive on homosexuality in the church that there is a higher incidence of homosexuality among certain well-established Latter-day Saint families than among others, which would suggest a genetic link for this condition. It would be useful to have data that would confirm or counter this anecdotal information. We need to have a better research, both historical and contemporary, and more of it, and we need to start a database that will serve as the basis for that research. That's the first suggestion. Second, I think we need to find more powerful ways of presenting the cause of homosexuality to our community. I suggest that one of the best ways to do this is through art forms. These might include a collection of poetry, fiction, and personal essays dealing with homosexuality among the Mormons. Perhaps some aspects of the Mormon homosexual experience could be dramatized in plays or films. Such expressions will help us to see homosexuals within the human context as real people with the same basic needs and desires as heterosexuals. Third, we need to be vigilant about the kind of language we use and the kind of language we allow others to use in regard to homosexuality. Here I am speaking not only of words that are clearly pejorative or prejudicial, but such terms as, quote, gay agenda, homosexual lifestyle, or simply the lifestyle. One never hears about the heterosexual lifestyle. We don't have one, I guess. Such terms as so-called homosexuals and presumed homosexuals, which play to the baser elements of stereotyping. Such language tends to dehumanize homosexuals. Fourth, we need to expand our strategies for informing the general church membership about the nature of homosexuality. There's so much mythology and misinformation circulating in our church culture that is destructive to homosexuals and their families. For example, mistakenly believe that homosexuality is contagious and that by merely associating with homosexuals, one may become homosexual. Responsible forums and informed dialogue can help people see both the complexity of same-sex orientation and our collective responsibility to ensure that homosexuals have all of the human and civil rights to which citizens of a free democracy are entitled. Fifth, we'd be willing to let our voices be heard in defense of our gay brothers and lesbian sisters. This means, among other things, countering prejudice, working to pass legislation that protects the rights of homosexuals, and helping to create a safe place within our schools and communities for those with same-sex attraction. Just before Proposition 22 came to a vote, and members of our ward were being asked to take pro-Proposition 22 placards and put them on their lawns, in our high priest, being the high priest group leader, said, now be sure and pick these up and take them after church. And then he said, of course, the gays will have them down within 20 minutes. And I said, excuse me? And he said, well, maybe it would take them an hour. And I said, excuse me? And he said, well, maybe it's wrong to say gays and lesbians would do this. And I said, yes. And that, I don't advocate getting in people's faces. I don't advocate, doing a big angry thing, but I think there are times when language and discussion can be stopped and turned in a positive direction in a quiet and, I hope, charitable way. Sixth, we need to extend family fellowship and similar organizations to other cities where families need help and support. At the same time, we need to begin building a network of people who can befriend, listen to, encourage, and bless homosexuals. In every city, we need to identify men and women, counselors, therapists, bishops, ex-bishops, relief society presidents, and ordinary saints to whom homosexual Latter-day Saints and their families can turn with confidence. I can't tell you how important I think this is. The loneliness of some people is so exquisite that it drives them to suicide or to other forms of self-destructive behavior or drives them simply out of the church. To have someone who can listen compassionately, who can listen with the full emphasis of what it means to be a Christian listener is required in all of our congregations. And unfortunately, there are many in which the people who are gay and lesbian have no one to turn to. Seventh, and perhaps most importantly, we must all be willing to comfort, love, and help these individuals and their families. We can do this by opening our hearts to them, by letting them know that we are available to listen to and, when necessary, bind up their wounds. We can become their nursing mothers, fathers, brothers, and sisters. Well, those are a few of the concrete things that I think that that we can do. I think every heterosexual in this room has gone through a transition. For me, it was from a transition of growing up in a homophobic family, in a homophobic community, in a homophobic congregation. Series of them, actually. And finally, finding something in the gospel of Jesus Christ that would not allow me to continue that, that challenged my thinking and my behavior. And so that also came from the people that I was privileged to counsel with as a bishop, who taught me something about their pain and their loneliness. And taught me something about my failure as a Christian to understand and reach out to them. In a letter that I wrote to a member of the Quorum of the Twelve recently, I said, I don't know what all the answers are. I only know that somehow we have to find a way of keeping these people from leaving the church or taking their lives. We are losing so many wonderful Latter-day Saints who need the church and who could make the invaluable contributions to the church. Most homosexuals that I know are not rebellious and are not out to undermine the church. Most wish to have a vital relationship with the church and are saddened that under current policy this is virtually impossible. I then go on to suggest that maybe one of the things that one of the doors that may be opening is what's happening in Vermont. If it becomes the law of the land in which same-sex relationships are at least legally sanctioned, perhaps we could find ourselves in the same position that the early Puritans did. Puritan literature is one of the fields of my specialization. And what happened in the early Puritan church is that the first generation that came here to seek religious freedom and to escape from religious persecution in England and elsewhere had such a piety that it was almost palpable. And they established the New England Congregational Churches. And one of the requirements for being a member of the New England Congregational Church is that you had to be able to stand in a testimony meeting and give the particulars of your conversion. On the 7th of March, I was listening to Reverend Hooker in the first church, and he was reading from John 3:17, and I felt my heart smitten, and I gave my life to Christ. Well, all of the first generation could say that. Their children grew up in the world. They knew their parents believed this, and they accepted it, but for many of them, there wasn't the same cauldron in which they could have that primary experience. And it created a crisis in the church, because if you couldn't do that, you couldn't be baptized and you couldn't partake of the sacrament. And so the church began to diminish in its membership, and it was a crisis. And so the New England divines met to see, how do we deal with this? And they came up with a wonderfully ingenious solution. It was called the Halfway Covenant. And with the Halfway Covenant, if you couldn't do this, if you were born of a member of the church, you were a child member of the church, but you couldn't, or even if you were of that generation, you couldn't do this, you could be baptized. You couldn't partake of the sacrament, but you could be baptized. So it was a Halfway Covenant. And it preserved the church. It kept the church alive until there was no longer a requirement that somebody had to do that. Well, as I said in this letter to this general authority, that it seemed to me that with the opening of legalization of these relationships, it might give the church an opportunity to say there is a way in which we can keep these people within the confines of the church. I don't have an enormous amount of hope for that. I mean, I have an enormous amount of hope for that. I don't have a lot of confidence that it will happen. I only know, brothers and sisters, that if we don't do this, if we don't find some way of doing this, that not only will a number of individual lives be impoverished, but the church itself will be greatly impoverished by these dear people who would want to stay and who would stay if somehow we could find a way for them to do so, and whose devotion and love and talent and Christian goodness we need in this church.
I'd like to thank all the panelists for their words on this subject and for speaking so well to these issues that we've raised today. We have about 15 minutes for questions and answers, and so if you have anything that you'd like to say, I would ask you to come up and use the microphone so that the comments or suggestions can be recorded. So. Yeah, come on up.
I can just be back there if you want.
Okay.
I haven't been to Sunstone probably in about a dozen years, and more than any other session today, this brought me here. And actually, I was sitting there. It was just amazing to me that the range of emotions it was bringing back for something that had been dormant for quite some time, because I hadn't really been affiliated with the church for about a dozen years either. And listening to the introductory remarks as far as the statements from the church and from the comments from people, although I had heard it in person, I had never heard Bob Rees speak before about this matter, but he's wonderfully enlightened. But on the other hand, it's still sad that I feel that really not much has changed in 15 years that this has been a topic with Sunstone. In the 15 years since the first time it was brought up as a panel, and Sunstone was kind of forced into it because Carolyn Pearson had written this book, Goodbye, I Love You, and I was on that panel. If you want a thrill to be a gay man to speak before 500 people, a couple of blocks from church headquarters, with the church spokesman, public relations director there, telling your life to that date, that was the experience that I had. But I feel that we're still just skirting around the issue because there is light years between the reality and the discussion. Because, as was said, that you know we're just like everybody else. And when you start off with the position that we're fundamentally flawed, that, well, even if you feel that way, don't act on it. So there's not an out like with heterosexual people that, well, you can get married, but basically you have chastity for life. And that's almost like saying, well, that God made mistakes. And that's something that wasn't kind of addressed here, and I don't think Sunstone wants to address that. But still, there is the issues of how do you integrate a people who are a sizable component. I like the idea that was said as far as as far as amongst some church leaders that there seemed to be a higher preponderance, because when I came out to my mother many, many, many years ago, I pointed out to her, well, look at your peer group, the high priest group in your ward. Fully half of those family had a gay or lesbian person, or were even some of the high priests themselves that were gay. And, you know, we went through that and realized that this is not something isolated. We're just society. We're part of life. And although a lot of mine is in the past, dealing with me now, and this is the only reference I'll make to Prop 22, like just yesterday I was there with some of my cousins, you know, I'm very close to, that welcoming back their son back from his mission. And these are the same people that I almost choked on the turkey at Thanksgiving when one of them was talking about going door to door. And then a little bit later, I would have to, I think it was at Christmas time or somewhere around then, that I would walk across the lawn past the yes on Prop 22 sign. And it was like something we didn't talk about, but I felt this was an attack on my very being. I'm not personally interested in marriage, gay marriage for myself, but it seemed to be an attack on my being. And it's that kind of thing that I feel that we need to bridge. And just one more thing, and I'll shut up because I realize that there's other comments and questions. But I love all the ideas that Bob Rees said. But the idea of reinstituting the Third Friday, I was never a part of those. That came after me. I think those are, particularly about Third Friday, I think that's all very well and good, but there has always been a gap between individual experience, whether it be with your church leaders locally or your families, from pronouncements from Salt Lake. And that creates a serious problem because, sure, after I told my bishop in the Santa Monica Singles Ward that, yes, I was gay and that I saw no reason to remain celibate under the circumstances, he not only did nothing about it, he called me to another church position the next week because he understood, you know, some of the issues that were involved. And that's happened in repeated cases where family members accept me. On the other hand, we can have the Third Friday. It may help some people that are in this area, but what about the teenager that's in Atascadero, where my cousin lives, or is in Lancaster, the country of Pete Knight, or in Irvine, or even in Glendale, closer, which is where I was excommunicated. And that was another very interesting experience because here I had spoken in front of how many hundreds of people right in front of Salt Lake. It wasn't until a couple years later when I had shared Carolyn Pearson's book with the rest of my family so that they would know more about me. She was troubled. She talked about it to her home teacher, went and talked to the bishop. This was out in rural California, who then reported it back to my stake president. My bishop called me and we discussed it. And, you know, it was through just simply sharing with my family. It wasn't even for any reported acts of behavior, but just simply for what I was. And I thought that was sad. We can't even share it within our families. And that is the outcome. Okay. I said far too much, but I did want to share another perspective because I really don't sense that there's very many gay people here. But until we can overcome that chasm between what Salt Lake says, and perhaps the things you suggested are the embryo for that to begin the discussion, but still after 15 years, we have so far to go, because when it's still considered the other, we'll never be welcome in the church. We're within the church, but will not remain so unless we're no longer considered the other. Thank you.
I think one of the solutions is that every family should have a gay member, and that might help, because it had an enormous positive effect on my family, and therefore it began to snowball and had a positive effect on my friends and on my associations. Today we've had three comments on this panel that refer to the ward I'm a member of, which is Westwood Second Ward. I'm going to try and do this without being emotional, because Bob Reese is as close to me as a brother as it is possible to be. Many years ago in Westwood Second Ward, Bob's courageous wife, Ruth, decided that she needed a little therapy, and she wasn't closed-mouthed about it. She talked about it among her friends. And little by little, we began to be a ward that kind of did that. I remember a Relief Society meeting in which we met as a group of sisters, and I think every woman in that group, that's when we held it on a weekday, interacted as though we were there kind of on this ship of fools together. And it seems to me that one of the things that we can do is that we can so expand our boundaries and not be discouraged about how close-minded or how unwelcoming our wards are, that if in our own personal little stewardship we are kind to others, if we include it in our lessons, if we make comments about it in our meetings. I remember teaching a Relief Society lesson when in a list of things I said that we needed to do and be as in order to be true Christians, I included to be loving to homosexual brothers and sisters. It was at the end of that lesson that a woman who was this ward came and in tears told me that she was in Los Angeles to be with her gay son who was dying of AIDS. And this was the first time she had ever heard that actually spoken in a church meeting, and how important that was for her. And I learned a really, really important lesson. If we don't talk about it, if we don't gently, in a Christ-like way, talk about the things that surround us, then nothing will change. And certainly the Westwood Second Ward wouldn't have gotten where it is if it hadn't been for Ruth and Bob and other members of the ward doing it.
Come on up. I teach at a public high school in Pasadena that has an awful lot of diversity, racial diversity, language diversity, and there's a large base of gay and lesbian students. And one of the things the gay and lesbian students have tried to do is start a club. They wanted to have teachers designated to be safe teachers, safe rooms, where they could go and not fear anyone tolerating slurs. And they asked me to be a safe teacher. It was an easy decision, but there have been a lot of uncomfortable moments along the way. It's not always easy. I think one thing we have to do as a group, and I don't mean just the straight people, I mean everyone in this boat, has to commit to the awkward, uncomfortable moments, the things that are hard for us. And we have to say, okay, this is way outside of my comfort zone, but I'm going to do it. Because That is the only way we make progress. If you look at the progress of racial relations in the United States, which, you know, I'm going to withhold value, but just say that there's been a lot of awkward, uncomfortable moments through history, and they haven't stopped. It's been a long process. But part of the procedure is that every person has to go through them if you want to make any progress. And that's all I want to say. I just think that progress can be made if we commit to those awkward, uncomfortable moments and find progress being made in our own lives through them.
Sorry, I just want to make one quick comment. My name is Bobby Reese. I'm un-gay. That only matters in that I can't fully understand the dilemma and pain that homosexual members and bisexual members of the church experience. I also appreciated some of the suggestions that my dad made, but I believe that most of those apply to us as heterosexuals, and I would like to make a suggestion to those of you who are homosexual or of other gender, and that is that you stay involved in the church in any way that you can. I can't imagine how difficult that would be, but we'll never make any progress without it. Thank you.
I was a member of the Third Friday group and was with it from almost the beginning. This was a very interesting experiment, and one that is truly wicked that it was canceled and destroyed, because it was finally a way that some kind of dialogue and communication and something practical could occur with the organizational church and its gay and lesbian members. President Anderson, who set it up, and someone really does need at some point to do a paper on the Third Friday group for Sunstone.